Chapter 1. Dragons are wonderful distractions. Sorsha and I learned that firsthand after I'd released a dragon by killing the mage that controlled it. As the dragon skimmed past the edge of the bluffs in the nearby town, it roared to announce its presence to any humans and animals that might be nearby. In response, most of the townspeople ran toward the river's edge to watch the beast fly by, and it was a perfect opportunity to slip through the wooden palisades and into the town unnoticed. We stood near the edge of the woods for a moment at the crest of a hill and studied the town. There were no stately buildings with long rows of columns or even much in the way of brick or stone. There was one wide main street, a central green, and a collection of one- and two-story wooden buildings with pointed roofs and picket fences. Everything looked freshly painted and well-maintained, including the palisade that protected the town. There was even a sign by the gate that welcomed us to New Rose. It was, in essence, the very picture of the type of town that had sprung up after the meteorite had destroyed the old earth. There was no one on guard duty by the open gate as we hobbled toward the wood barrier, though I wasn't sure if that was the policy of the town, or if the guard had gone to watch the dragon as well. Whatever the reason, it meant we could slip inside unnoticed, despite the fact that we were covered in blood, both ours and that of the mages we'd just destroyed. We spotted the sign for the healer near the town green and limped toward the blue house as quickly as we could manage. The healer had just stepped outside to see what all the commotion was about when Sorsha and I stumbled through the gate and started up the walk.
Oh, look at you!
The woman exclaimed as she took in our appearances. The healer was close to our age, with a tidy bun of dark brown hair and a pair of large cat-green eyes. She scurried toward us, then stopped when she couldn't decide who to help inside first. We made it easy for her and limped inside under our own strength. The healer guided us through the first door on the right and into what was clearly the room she used to examine her patients. There was a long, flat table that I recognized from my own visits to various doctors and healers over the years, as well as three chairs. The healer hesitated again as she tried to decide where to place us. Sorsha dropped into one of the chairs while I stepped into the hall and piled our bags on the floor. I removed my jacket and wrapped it around the .22 Ruger rifle before standing it next to our bags, then tucked the snub nose into one of the satchels.
What happened?
The healer asked as I stepped back into the room and took the chair next to Sorsha. She gathered up several vials, then fluttered around us as she looked over what she could see of our wounds.
We were attacked in the forest,
Sorsha offered.
By what?
The healer asked in disbelief. But Sorsha's voice seemed to prompt the healer into action, and she didn't wait for an answer. She laid both hands on Sorsha's shoulders, then closed her eyes. A glow moved from the healer's hands to Sorsha's shoulders, then spread out slowly from there. The healer frowned in concentration, and I saw Sorsha wince a couple of times. After several minutes, the healer opened her eyes and stepped back. For a moment, she looked like she would topple over, and both Sorsha and I started to stand up, but then the healer held up her hand and moved over to the table. She took a deep breath, which seemed to steady her, but then she leaned against the table and closed her eyes again. I looked over at Sorsha as she quietly checked her wounds. She nodded to let me know that she was healed, but I could see a concerned look on the blonde mage's face as she watched the healer.
Sorry.
The healer apologized as she opened her eyes and took another deep breath.
I was up all night delivering a pair of twins who were born about a month too soon. Are they all right?
Sorsha asked.
Oh, they'll be fine,
the healer assured her.
But it took a bit out of me. I'll be okay in a minute.
We both nodded and waited for a moment.
I'll get you some water,
Sorsha offered as she stood up.
Oh, thank you,
the healer replied as she fanned herself with her hand.
There should be some fresh lemonade on the counter in the kitchen. That would be wonderful.
Sorsha smiled at the healer and then shrugged at me. My lover left the room, and I was tempted to follow. After all the tracks we had just survived, I wasn't in the most trusting of moods, especially around a mage.
Now, would you care to explain why you have dragon blood all over you?
The healer asked in a pleasant voice when Sorsha had left.
You and your friend weren't attacked by some bear in the forest, that's for sure.
It was a dragon, I agreed as I felt myself tense up. I wondered if she had her own communication link to the Magisterium and if she would report us as soon as the opportunity arose.
Which means a mage,
the healer pointed out.
Well, I don't suppose it's any of my business, and I never discuss my patients with anyone, not even the Magisterium. But if the mage that you fought was powerful enough to have a dragon, then I would guess more will be on the way. Now, I'll help you too because you need my skills, and I never turn anyone away who needs my help. But then, you two have to leave. This town doesn't need the kind of trouble you'll bring.
That was the plan, I assured her. We have no interest in staying. The healer watched me for a moment, nodded, moved behind me, and placed her hands on my shoulders. I closed my eyes as the warmth of her magic started to flow through me. I could hear Sorsha return to the room and the sound of glasses being placed on the surface. When the healer released my shoulders, I opened my eyes and rolled my neck from side to side. Sorsha had poured us each a glass of lemonade, and she handed one to me and one to the healer when the mage stepped away from me. The healer accepted the glass gratefully and then dropped into the third chair in the room.
I may have to close the office for the rest of the day,
she commented after she drank about half the glass.
I don't think I have enough energy left to do anything more than zap a pimple. Thank you for helping us,
Sorsha said quickly. Maybe you could help us with one other thing, I suggested, as I stood up and returned to the hall. I pawed through the bags until I'd found the atlas that Evan had given us and returned to the room. The healer looked intrigued by the atlas, but I also caught the look she cast out the window. She was worried about how much time we had already spent here, and I didn't want to stay any longer either. I flipped to the page Evan had shown us, then held it out toward the healer. We need to go to this town, I said as I pointed to Morristown. I think it's called Motown now. The healer carefully took the atlas from my hand and studied the complex web of roads. She frowned as she tried to make sense of what was on the old map versus what she knew about the current layout of towns and roads.
Well, if I'm reading this correctly, you need to go north a bit,
the healer drawled.
Just past the town walls, you'll see a road on the western edge of the town. That will take you towards some of these old cities and the place with the old flying machines. This road that's labeled 78 is probably the Hill Road. It's nice and wide, and there's always plenty of traffic. You can follow that toward this one that says 287. That's now the Outer Post Road, I think. Or most of it is. Then you just head north to Motown.
I took the atlas back from her and studied the path she'd described. But what about this road? I said as I handed her the map again, and pointed toward a smaller road with the number 124 that ran straight from a branch of 78 to Morristown. It would save us days of travel if we could find it. Isn't there at least a trail or something there now?
That?
The healer scoffed.
No, you don't want to use that, no matter how many mages are following you. That's a mutant wasteland. Oh, I didn't know there were any this close to the city.
Sorsha gulped.
I thought they were all deep in the interior of the continent. No,
the healer laughed.
There are small pockets here and there. Sometimes it's just easier to dump them nearby rather than rounding them up and moving them to a reservation in the middle of nowhere.
Sorsha and I exchanged uncertain looks.
I really have no desire to be eaten by mutants,
Sorsha noted wryly. Neither do I agreed. So I guess we're taking the long road.
It's a pretty walk,
the healer added.
And plenty of places to eat and sleep along the way.
Sounds like just what we need. Well, thank you for everything. We don't have much, but we're happy to repay you in some way.
I think the best you could do is leave,
the healer replied with a sigh. She wasn't mean or angry with her request, but there was definitely fear in her voice. She glanced toward the window again, and Sorsha and I took that as our cue. Thanks again, I said as I stood up and shook the healer's hand. The healer nodded but didn't move from the chair. She gave us a nod and tried to smile, but her eyes drifted back toward the window again, and concern flitted across her features before her gaze found us again. There didn't seem to be anything else to say, so Sorsha and I returned to the hallway alone where we reclaimed our property, then stepped back outside. I saw that the crowd had moved away from the bluffs and toward the green where groups of people started to gather. It wasn't hard to guess what the topic was, and I hoped the dragon distraction would last until we cleared the palisades and found the road. We hustled down the sidewalk and turned toward the west, away from the townsfolk who were still discussing the dragon. A few curious people glanced our way as we hurried by, but we made it past most of the businesses and homes before anyone really looked at us. Even then, I thought we would make it out of town before anyone else knew we had been there. We found the road the healer had mentioned just outside the palisade. It was wide enough for carts and flat and hard from all the traffic that used it. A passing coach kicked up a cloud of dust while a group of local women walked past, deep in conversation. We stepped onto the road, and then Sorsha grabbed my hand as she looked around.
"There's a mage near here,"
she hissed.
"I can feel his thoughts. I think he's looking for us."
"Then let's get out of here," I replied, as I started to jog along the road.
"I'm really growing tired of this,"
Sorsha growled.
"I'd like to have one day where we don't end up running somewhere."
"At least we found the healer," I pointed out.
"Maybe we should have invited her to come with us,"
Sorsha replied.
"At the rate we're going, we'll need her services at least twice a day by the time we reach the west coast."
I started to laugh, but was cut off by a rumbling sound behind us. I didn't bother to turn around. I just pulled Sorsha into a stand of trees and behind a massive oak. When I peeked around the trunk, I could see that the other people on the road looked confused. A few moved onwards, but most had stopped and looked around. Another rumble vibrated through the air, and this time people started to run in whatever direction looked good.
"What do you see?"
Sorsha whispered. "Nothing yet. Any ideas as to who or what this is?"
"None. I don't think I've ever heard that sound before. It's not thunder, exactly."
"It's getting closer, so I guess we'll find out." The wait was interminable, and even the animals in the woods had gone quiet. It felt like the whole world held its breath until the source of the low growl came into view.
"What?"
Sorsha stuttered. Three mages walked down the center of the road with matching grim looks on their faces. But that wasn't the scary part of their parade. One of the mages, a tall man with an enormous mustache, held a heavy chain in both hands. The other end of the chain was attached to a collar that wrapped around the neck of a long-snouted creature with sharp teeth and stubby legs. A large tail swished through the dirt behind it as it marched down the road. It had to be 8 feet long from the tip of its flat nose to the end of its tail. The creature stopped at the point where we had left the road some 50 yards away and raised its head. It sniffed the air, then let out another rumbling call. It wasn't a roar, exactly, maybe more like a very deep bellow. I could actually feel the sound in my bones, and some deep-seated instinct made me want to run. But I reminded myself I had the guns and the advantage, at least for a few more moments.
"Gun mage!"
a black-haired man called out as he scanned the surrounding area. Even from our spot behind the oak, I could see the ice blue of his eyes and feel the anger that rippled through him.
"Gun mage!"
the black-haired man called again when I didn't respond.
"You cannot win this battle. If you surrender now, the Magisterium will help you. But if you insist on following the insurgent, then we have no choice but to kill both of you right here."
The beast on the end of the chain made another bellow, and I felt Sorsha shiver in response. I gave her hand a reassuring squeeze as I eased the Ruger rifle from beneath my coat. There was no way the small bullets would penetrate the thick hide of the dragon beast, but they would cut through a human skull just fine. So I scanned the three mages and debated which one to take out first. The only one whose magic was obvious was the one holding the chain of the beast, though I couldn't imagine the thing could move quickly with those stubby legs. Taking out one or two of the mages first seemed like the best plan.
"How quickly do you think they can throw up a shield?"
I asked quietly as I tried to determine which one would be in charge of creating the shield.
"A Magisterium gun mage?"
Sorsha whispered back.
"Pretty quickly. But I'd say that one at the back with the curls and the nervous twitch is in charge of the shield. If you can get to him first, the others may not be able to protect themselves as quickly."
I nodded, then pointed the rifle toward the man Sorsha had pointed out. He stood the furthest away from the beast, and his fingers twirled in an endless circular motion. His left eye kept blinking as well, and he grimaced every time his glance fell on the creature. The whip-crack sound of the rifle snapped as soon as I pulled the trigger, and I felt the surge of power from the gun as the bullet flew down the barrel and then across the field. I kept the stock ready, and I knew the bullet was straight and true, just like the Ruger that launched it. The sound of the rifle startled the mages for a moment, but no one moved until the twitchy mage gurgled and started to fall. His mage robe had a large black stain now, right about where his heart would be. His companions stared at him in surprise until the black-haired mage seemed to have a moment of clarity.
"He still has a gun!" the man yelled out as he started to throw up a shield.
The mustachioed man with the chain suddenly snapped his fingers. The collar around the beast's neck dropped to the ground, and the man hissed at the beast. The beast bellowed once more as it trundled toward us. I fired a shot at the spot between the eyes, but as I expected, the creature didn't stop. In fact, it picked up its pace, and I was surprised to see just how fast the cart-sized beast could move.
"Hell!"
I muttered, as the warning bell started to sound inside my head. I had learned the hard way not to ignore that sound once it started to ring inside me. It meant I had one shot left in whatever firearm I was using at the moment, and then the gun would vanish from my hand. After 24 hours, I could reproduce the gun again, but that wasn't much use to me when I had two mages and an angry creature to deal with right now. I fired the last shot from the rifle, this time further down the body. The gun vanished from my grip as soon as the bullet cleared the tip of the barrel, but I held the pose a fraction longer, as if I could keep the bullet on its trajectory. The creature paused at the sound of the rifle, and a moment later, I saw a trickle of blood along its hide. For a moment, I actually thought I'd managed to at least stop it. But it was nearly on us by then, and its massive jaws opened to reveal even more rows of long and pointy teeth. It made another bellowing noise and charged toward us. This time, I didn't ignore the urge to run.
"Go!"
I yelled at Sorsha. The Irish mage didn't need any more encouragement from me. She took off through the trees as fast as I had ever seen her move. I followed after her, and the strange mage beast nipped at my heels. I soon realized that the beast wasn't very good at changing directions, especially when there were so many trees and other obstacles about, so I grabbed Sorsha's hand and started to lead her on a winding path through the woods. Every time the beast would get close, we would veer off in another direction. It was a great strategy, and we managed to put some distance between us and our pursuer until we found ourselves standing on the edge of a gorge. A good 30 feet below, I could see boulders and sharp rocks, and the white froth of a fast-moving river. Just to the west, I could see a wooden bridge, no doubt the crossing point for the road we'd been on.
"Shit!"
Sorsha and I both declared at the same time.
"You're rubbing off on me,"
the mage remarked as she looked into the rapids. "In a good way, I hope," I noted as I tried to gauge how wide the gorge was. It was too far to jump, and there wasn't any other obvious way to get across. The rumbling sound stirred the air around us, and we both turned back toward the trees.
"I need the snubnose,"
I gulped as I started to dig through the satchel I carried. Thankfully, the small revolver seemed to be attracted to my hand the way two magnets can be. I felt the grip slide into my hand and pulled the weapon from the bag. The beast muscled its way from the undergrowth and then stopped to stare at us with two pale yellow eyes. It started forward slowly, like it wasn't sure why we had stopped, and for a moment I wondered if it couldn't see the edge clearly. As it started forward again, I pulled Sorsha behind me. Then I let the beast get as close as I dared before I pointed the snub nose at one yellow eye. The boom of the little gun rebounded through the forest, and the blue flame sparked to life as the .357 Magnum bullet found its mark. The yellow eye exploded from the impact, and the beast bellowed again. I saw a trickle of blood as well as some sort of green pus that oozed from the socket. The beast shook its head very slowly, as if it could dislodge the bullet, but then it started to flounder along the edge of the gorge. Its head drooped and started to drag through the dirt, and I was reminded of the body of a decapitated chicken I'd once seen run around the barnyard. The creature's tail slipped over the side of the gorge first, and its rear end soon followed after. its feet still scratched at the rock, but the long claws couldn't find any purchase in the hard surface. The rest of the body toppled over the side, and then, finally, the massive jaws.
"Let's get to the bridge, before the mages!"
We ran along the edge of the gorge toward the bridge. It was a simple structure compared to the one we'd used to leave Brook Island, and not nearly as long. It was also busy with plenty of foot traffic as well as a cart and a few riders. But as we got closer, I could see that the people on the bridge were milling around in confusion, and a few had even started to panic. Raised voices and screams drifted toward us, as most of the people ran away from the crossing as quickly as they could. A handful stood close to either end of the bridge and stared around, as if they thought they might spot the source of the explosion they'd heard.
"Time to get!"
I heard one of the riders call out as he looked back down the road in the direction of New Rose. That was all the encouragement the rest of the people needed. As they caught sight of something moving toward them on the road, they quickly scattered as far from the bridge as they could get. The crossing was soon empty, and the only thing I could hear was the sound of the river rushing far below. We inched closer and were nearly at the foot of the bridge when we spotted the distinctive red robes of the Magisterium on the road. Sorsha and I quickly ducked into a stand of young trees and watched as the mages strode past us and onto the bridge.
"So much for getting ahead of them,"
Sorsha muttered. The two mages stopped near the near side of the bridge and peered over the edge. The mage with the chain shook his head as he watched the rushing waters below, and I thought he might have been crying. The dark-haired man snapped something at the man, then hit him almost hard enough on the shoulder to knock him over the bridge. The man with the chain turned an angry glare on his companion, but he didn't say or do anything else. For a moment, I thought the two mages would move on. They started forward, and the black-haired man seemed focused on something further down the road. But then he stopped and scanned along the edges of the gorge. I slowly lifted the snub nose with both hands and aimed at the dark-haired man. I eased the hammer back as quietly as I could, though the click sounded like an explosion in the quiet forest. The dark-haired man swiveled toward the sound even as he started to raise his shield. I pulled back on the heavy trigger, and the blast from the snub nose echoed across the gorge. Flames and smoke shot forth, and the scent of sulfur and charcoal drifted past me. I saw a ribbon of red blood curl into the air, and then the dark-haired mage dropped from view. I was pretty happy with my shot from that distance, but then the alarm sounded in my head again. I bit off another curse word and tried to figure out how soon I could summon the next gun. I had at least one more mage to deal with, any number of more ordinary dangers that we might meet as we made our way north, and only one bullet left in the snub nose. One problem at a time, I told myself as I took a deep breath. Before I started to worry about boogeymen on the road, I needed to know for sure how many mages I had to deal with at the bridge. I'd seen the dark-haired mage reach toward his left shoulder before collapsing in a bloody spray. I wasn't sure if he was dead, although there had been a great deal of splatter as he went down. Unfortunately, the other mage had learned his lesson. He ducked out of sight the instant the gun had boomed, and all I could see of him was a few tufts of his hair as he crouched below the side of the bridge.
"We have to get across that bridge," I pointed out, "which means we need to get past those mages."
"I don't think they're going anywhere,"
Sorsha replied as she peered around my shoulder. We crept the last few feet to the edge of the bridge and peered around the trunk of a tree hung over the gorge. I spotted the two mages near the middle of the bridge, near the spot where I had shot the dark-haired mage. That mage was definitely dead. Blood ran from the wound above his heart and spilled between the boards, then down into the river below. Even in death, he somehow still had an icy glare. The surviving mage crouched behind the side of the bridge. He had his back toward us, though he must have felt our stares. He glanced over his shoulder, then started to scuttle the rest of the way across the bridge. I raised the gun, but Sorsha placed a hand on my arm.
"He's leaving,"
Sorsha pointed out.
"And I don't think he's heading back to the Magisterium anytime soon."
"Why not?"
I asked suspiciously as the mage scrambled onto the road on the other side of the bridge.
"He wants to find that beast. That's all he's thinking about now."
The mage made it to his feet, though he was still stooped over. He ran into the trees, and we could hear him as he moved toward the rim of the gorge. A few moments later, I spotted the red of his robe among the trees as he followed the path of the river. Bit by bit, people started to emerge from the forest. A few walked cautiously toward the dead mage, while others offered to go for help. "We need to leave before any officials get here," I said, as I placed the snub nose in my pocket. The alarm was still going off in my brain, but not as loudly once I let go of the grip. It was more like background noise now, which at least let me focus on our present problem. Sorsha nodded, and we stepped cautiously onto the road. We walked toward the bridge and the body of the mage. There were quite a few people gathered around him now, and most of those people spoke about a black mage. The rest of the crowd, though, were clearly not interested in lingering near the site of the battle, either because of the possibility that a black mage was still on the loose, or because the local authorities would soon be there. Sorsha and I joined the flow of people that moved at a quick sprint to get away from the area. No one spoke as we moved along, and no one looked back. The crowd thinned out the further north we went, and soon it was just the two of us for long stretches. The sun was low in the sky by the time we found anything larger than a farm. I pulled out the atlas one more time as we huddled under a walnut tree and decided we must have reached the area near 78. Several large roads all converged on this point, and as we stepped from the trees, I could even see the old highways. I spotted one of the original green signs with 78 and an arrow and pointed it out to Sorsha.
"It's getting late. Should we at least stop for food somewhere?"
"I wouldn't mind sitting down," I agreed. As we followed the sign for 78, we noticed several of the pre-magic buildings were still in use. One huge building with blue paint was especially busy. Mage lights and gas lights lit the building as well as the old parking lot, and hordes of people flowed through the area. Carts, wagons, horses, and even a couple of dog carts sat nearby, all under the watchful eye of a group of men in lime green shirts. The crowd was almost festive, and the chatter drowned out just about everything else, except the music that blared from the rooftop.
"Maybe it's some sort of shopping area,"
Sorsha suggested as we hesitated near the entrance. "What's an Ica?" I asked as I studied the sign that hung overhead. "Is it some sort of cooking, like French or something?" Sorsha shrugged but pulled me along toward the main entrance anyway. A group of young people wearing the same blue shirts and red trousers stood just inside the doors and handed everyone who stepped inside a pamphlet. Sorsha thanked them, then tugged me deeper into the building before anyone could comment on our appearances. The building felt more like a warehouse than shops or offices, and it was enormous. I couldn't even see the end of the building despite the high ceilings and the complete lack of walls. Well, that wasn't quite accurate. There were all sorts of strange sort of walls, like something the traveling shows used whenever they put on a play. Between these walls were rooms like you would find in a house, filled with furniture. There were whole rows of dining rooms, kitchens, bedrooms, bathrooms, and even an entire section labeled as entertainment centers. People sat in the rooms and talked with someone in a tan uniform. Signs near each room gave a person's name and specified what topics they could help you with. Some of the rooms had lines of people waiting patiently for their chance to consult, while others were empty except for the uniformed specialist. "What is this?" I murmured, as we strolled past a popular section devoted to solving marital problems.
"I'm not sure how to describe it,"
Sorsha replied quietly. She had studied the pamphlet as we moved through the rooms, and now she pulled me out of the flow of traffic and into a rest and recovery spot filled with overstuffed chairs. A few other people were already there, so Sorsha pulled me to a pair of less comfortable-looking chairs near the back. "Is this some sort of advice center?" I asked.
"Yes,"
she stated as she tried to find a way to sit on the hard, smooth surface of the chair without sliding out.
"But it's all part of a church, I guess is what you would call it."
"A church?" I asked in surprise.
"Devoted to magic and the magisterium. All of these consultants are supposedly trained by the magisterium, and whatever they can't solve, they will forward to an appropriate mage for magical intervention. For the right price. Or if you can't afford that, they'll say prayers for you. Also for the right price.
I've never even heard of such a thing, I snickered.
I guess it makes sense,
Sorsha noted as she looked over the pamphlet again.
Most people don't have a mage handy that they can consult whenever they have a problem. And if there's a mage nearby, he can probably only help you with one or two things, like curing your flock or making it rain.
I tried to imagine anyone consulting with either Peter or Preston, the two brats with minimal magic who'd been my nemeses growing up. I certainly wouldn't trust them to cure a sick cow, much less conjure up a rainstorm to save the crops. So all these people just come here to ask for advice or get help from a mage? I asked.
That's what they claim. I have no idea if they have any actual ties to the magisterium.
I guess this means there's no food in here. I sighed as I watched the hordes move between the various experts.
Doesn't look like it. But there have to be restaurants nearby. Someone has to feed all these visitors.
We gave up our seats and rejoined the flow of people. The arrows painted on the floor led us through a maze of similar fake rooms and past a long row of shelves like the ones we'd seen at Home Depot. These had all been filled with a variety of potions, cures, and an assortment of magical items. At least, that's what the sign said. People picked through the shelves as they looked for items recommended by their consultant, then made their way to the cashiers near the exit. We slipped past the people waiting to pay for their items and stepped back outside. We moved to the side to study the other buildings in the area in the hopes of finding some place that had food. As we took in the possibilities, a woman in one of the tan uniforms approached us. She was in her 50s and sported a gray ponytail. She walked up to us with a friendly smile, a thick notebook in one hand, and a mage crystal in her other hand. It was hard to miss the incandescent glow that lit up the center of the crystal, and both Sorsha and I tensed up as the woman stopped in front of us. The crystals could be used for any number of purposes depending on the magic placed on them, but the fact that she approached us out of everyone was enough to send my hand toward the pocket where I'd tucked the snub nose.
Oh, you're mages,
she purred as she held up the crystal for us to study.
I've never ever actually had one of the stones go off before, so this is very exciting. Of course, we're honored to have you here. I can't tell you how exciting it is to have such magic in our presence.
Sorsha mumbled.
Thanks. Are you here to offer services?
The woman asked, hopefully.
Sorsha
muttered. We're just passing through, I replied. We're on a quest, but we needed a moment to recuperate.
A quest?
The woman cooed.
How exciting.
We were hoping to get something to eat, I prompted as the woman batted her eyelashes at me.
Oh, you'll want them all then,
she said in a disappointed voice.
But have you registered yet? They won't let you in if you haven't registered.
Registered? Sorsha and I repeated at the same time.
At the Northern States offices,
the woman explained.
All non-residents have to register when they arrive or they can't use any of the services, and mages have to specify what type of magic they have.
Oh, we didn't know.
It's not a big deal,
the woman quickly assured us.
It's just a safety precaution, what with all the people who come here. I'm sure they'll be happy to help you, since you're on a quest. But we don't need to register,
Sorsha noted. Her voice had dropped to something deeper and smoother that was both sexy and hypnotic. It was the voice she used when she deployed her magic, and I watched the woman curiously to see if she or the stone would realize what was happening.
Why, of course you don't need to register,
the woman agreed after she blinked.
You were going to give us vouchers and passes for them all,
Sorsha purred.
Here are your vouchers and passes,
the woman replied as she opened the notebook. She flipped through a few sheets of loose paper, then handed two tickets to Sorsha along with two half sheets of blue paper.
Don't forget, we're on a special quest, so you won't tell anyone you've seen us,
Sorsha added.
I won't say a word to anyone,
the woman agreed. Ask her how we get to the mall, I whispered to Sorsha.
How do we get to the mall?
Sorsha asked.
Take the orange tram,
the woman replied.
Now, go back inside,
Sorsha commanded. The woman smiled and tottered back toward the doors. I'm really starting to like this magic of yours, I mused.
Uh-huh. I think I see our ride, by the way.
An orange cart pulled by a pair of draft horses had pulled into the lot and moved toward the Ica exit. A small crowd had started to gather near a pole painted the same color of orange, and we fell in near the back. Only a few people tumbled from the cart once the horses stopped, but it was a full load heading back. Sorsha and I managed to press ourselves on board, though I felt a twinge of sympathy for the horses who had to pull this load of humanity to the mall. Luckily, it wasn't a very long ride, and the horses left the old highway when we reached a gold-lettered sign that said Liberty Mall. The mall turned out to be a sprawling complex of odd-shaped buildings gathered around a circular road. Some of the buildings were connected, while others were standalones. The cart stopped at each building in front of a sign that listed what stores and businesses were located in that wing. The signs were long, and it was almost impossible to read each one before the wagon would move again. But the most amazing thing about the buildings were the walls made of glass. Every place we stopped at had an entire wall of windows that provided a view into a well-lit and inviting interior. There were soaring ceilings, murals of flying machines, and even aerialists at one location. I stared in fascination at each building as we pulled up, lost in the sheer strangeness of it. Sorsha finally pulled me from the wagon at one of the last buildings and dragged me inside. She handed our guest passes to a man and a woman just inside the door.
"We're guests of Ica,"
Sorsha pronounced in her soothing voice.
"You'll let us inside without asking any more questions."
"Please, go on in,"
the woman declared.
"We're always happy to welcome special guests of the IKEA."
"IKEA," I murmured as we strode inside. We wandered around the two-story building, and I quickly discovered that the walls of windows extended throughout the structure. As we made our way down a long concourse, I could even see old flying machines still parked on the concrete. I know I looked like a country bumpkin as I stopped to stare at everything, but I didn't care. Sorsha gave up and left me by one of the windows while she went in search of food. She reappeared several minutes later with some hand pies, a paper sack filled with crispy potatoes, and a cup of tea for herself and a cup of coffee for me. We sat down on a ledge in front of one of the windows and watched the lights of the city start to come on. "I don't care what they said in the museum," I finally declared after I'd eaten half of my pie. "I think those things could fly across an ocean."
"I wonder what it's like to ride in one,"
Sorsha mused.
"It must have been very cold, like when you climb a mountain and it's always so cold near the top."
"I think they could control the temperature. I don't know how, but I think you could just wear your regular clothes." Sorsha laughed, but she didn't disagree with me either. When we'd polished off the last of the potatoes and finished our drinks, Sorsha directed me to one of the stores.
"How much money do you have left?"
Most of what I came to the city with. There wasn't much of a chance to spend it."
"We can pick up some supplies then. And there's a place where we can get a room for the night in the next concourse."
"I guess you aren't too keen about camping next to the road," I teased.
"And miss out on the glamour of Liberty Mall,"
she laughed. We found some jerky and some nut mix to add to our supplies, as well as some fire sticks that were guaranteed to work even in pouring rain. I paid the bill, then peered inside my money pouch. "Okay, so maybe it wasn't as much as I thought," I murmured as we stepped back into the concourse. "We may have to camp after all."
"Well, I hate to not pay people, but we really need some clean clothes. We're drawing quite a few looks, and I can't make all of them forget us. I'll take care of this next one."
"We'll be fine. Besides, whatever we pick up will just get dirty anyway." Sorsha rolled her eyes and then pulled me into another store, one that promised the latest fashions in every size. She picked up a new pouch, which she filled with clean clothes for both of us, then walked up to the clerk when no one else was in the store.
"Have you found everything you need?"
the clerk asked brightly. The clerk was 16 if she was a day, and she set down the romance novel she had been reading as soon as Sorsha appeared at the cash register.
"We did,"
Sorsha agreed in her magical voice.
"And we've already paid."
"Do you need a receipt?"
the clerk asked.
"For returns?"
"No,
no receipts,
Sorsha said with a smile.
We'll let you return to your novel, and you'll forget we were here.
The clerk nodded and picked up the book again while Sorsha and I left the store. Sorsha sorted through the clothes and then handed a set to me.
Go change,
she instructed as she made her way toward the women's restroom. I shrugged, though Sorsha had already turned her back on me, and I strolled over to the nearby men's room. Though I'd griped about the clothes, it did feel good to strip off the dirt and blood-encrusted clothing we'd been wearing. I even managed to scrub off most of the day's dirt, so I was nice and clean myself when I slipped on the forest green shirt and the denim pants. I tossed the old clothes into my satchel and wondered if the Wonders of Liberty Mall included a place to do laundry. I spotted Sorsha in yet another store as I stepped from the men's room, and I stopped for a moment to drink in the sight. She had cleaned up as well, and she glowed in the soft mage light that lit the store. Her thick golden hair hung in waves around her shoulders and created a halo effect around her head that only emphasized her high cheekbones and the perfect oval of her face. Her green eyes reminded me of grass on a summer's day, and for a moment I could have sworn I smelled freshly mown grass and a field of wildflowers. The pale yellow shirt and denim pants she'd changed into emphasized the luscious curves of her body, without putting everything on full display. In short, she was a sight to behold, and I was more than happy to stand there and enjoy it. I wasn't alone in that sentiment either. Everyone who went by stole a glance at her, yet she remained oblivious to their stares. After drinking in the sight for several moments, I shook myself from the dream state and started toward her. Somehow she seemed to sense my presence. She looked up from the book she held and scanned the area like someone who has heard their name yelled out in a crowded area. When she saw me, she gave me a smile that made me ache to hold her again. I nearly ran into the store just to get close to her. "Don't we have enough books?" I teased when I sidled up next to her.
"You can never have enough books, but I think you'll like this one."
"Cities of New Jersey," I read aloud as she showed me the book cover.
"It has street maps for the cities in New Jersey, including Morristown."
"How old is it?" I asked as she flipped to the page for Morristown.
"The clerk says these are reprints of old books that the owner found. People like to collect them for some reason. The originals were all printed in 1996, so ages ago."
"So the roads might have changed between then and the meteorite," I pointed out.
"True, but it does match with the atlas Evan gave us, so all the major roads seem to be the same."
"Fine. Let's get it. Then maybe we can investigate this hotel." Sorsha smiled again and sauntered over to the register. While she and the cashier discussed other pre-magic replicas that the store carried, and Sorsha quietly worked her magic, I stepped back into the concourse. I found a spot near one of the windows where I could keep an eye on Sorsha and leaned back against a pillar to watch the shoppers as they moved from store to store. Sorsha had finally finished her business in the replica store when I noticed a shift among the other shoppers. People started to whisper, and a few looked back over their shoulders. Several people scurried down the concourse as quickly as they could, so I bolted toward the replica store and snatched Sorsha's hand just as she stepped into the concourse.
"What?"
she started to ask. "I'm not sure, but everyone coming from that other building looks unhappy," I replied, as I started to look for an exit. "And it's gotten rather quiet. I only know one thing that can cause a reaction like that."
"Red robes,"
Sorsha hissed as she glanced over her shoulder. "This way," I said, as I saw a mall employee duck through a service door tucked behind a plant. It was hard to believe that in a hall filled with doors it was almost impossible to find one that still worked or wasn't alarmed. Most of the doors that had been used to load the flying machines had long since been sealed, and those that were still open led to flying machines that had been converted to dining establishments. The service door was our best option, and judging by the level of panic from our fellow shoppers, possibly our only option. The service door led into a narrow hallway with a glass wall on one side and plain concrete on the other. The floor was covered with a hard black material that reminded me of some of the plastic on display at the museum. Flat, round shapes had been molded into the flooring for some reason, but I didn't have time to contemplate yet another oddity of the pre-magic world. we followed the narrow hallway to a juncture point where several service hallways met. Mall employees moved up and down the hallways, intent on their own business. There was also a pair of stairs that led down to a lower level. There was only one small light down below, and it was hard to see anything that might be hiding in the darkness.
"Which way?"
Sorsha asked as we looked at the identical service areas. "Let's try down," I suggested.
"We don't know what's down there,"
Sorsha protested.
"There's got to be an exit," I replied as I started down the stairs. "One the mages probably don't know about."
"I hope you're right,"
Sorsha sighed as she followed after me. At the bottom of the stairs, Sorsha conjured up a small flame. It barely illuminated the surrounding area, but it was enough to keep me from crashing into the pre-magic vehicles that were parked in the area. There were dozens of them, and some even had wagons attached. Suitcases littered the floor as well, and we had to give up on moving quickly. On the plus side, the mages wouldn't be able to move any faster if they somehow figured out where we were. I snickered at the thought of a slow chase through the pre-magic rubble, then reminded myself we wanted to be quiet. Near the far end of this weird parking lot, I spotted what I'd hoped to find, the ubiquitous exit sign that so many of these old buildings seem to have. Now I just had to hope that the doors I could see hadn't been sealed like the ones upstairs. As we approached the doors, I could see that they were heavy and made of metal, with a long horizontal rod in place of a handle. The door on the left also had doorstops at the top and bottom that looked like they were rusted shut, but the door on the right had no such problems. I climbed over the last suitcase and tested the right side door. It moved ever so slightly, then stopped when it encountered something on the other side. I stood back for a moment, took a deep breath, then pushed against the door as hard as I could. The door moved maybe another 2 inches, but it refused to do more than that. A swift kick couldn't budge it either. I finally put my shoulder against it, as did Sorsha, and together we pushed with every ounce of strength we could muster. The hinges screeched, and I heard something on the other side of the doors topple to the ground, but the door slowly gave way. We squeezed through when there was just enough room for us to fit, and found ourselves on a hard patch of concrete, surrounded by flying machines and an assortment of abandoned luggage. "Okay, well, we're outside. Now all we need to do is figure out where 78 is." Sorsha pulled out the new book with a triumphant wave. She flipped through the pages until she found one that showed the roads around the Newark International Airport. She turned the book a few times to try to orient it with the surrounding scene, then pointed toward the left.
"That way,"
she declared.
"Are you sure?"
I asked as I squinted into the darkness. There was just a field of concrete as far as the eye could see, and very little light to see by.
"I'm sure,"
she said as she tucked the book back into her satchel.
"Better douse the light," I suggested. "No reason to make it too easy for them to follow us."
"Right,"
Sorsha agreed as our paltry little flame flickered and died away. There was a crashing sound in the room behind us, followed by the sound of luggage being tossed to the side. I shoved the door closed, threw some of the suitcases in front of the exit, and then bolted after Sorsha as she ran across the endless concrete.